Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
Stephen Seddon was a man who had nurturing parents that always helped him out financially, so much so they had even remortgaged their own home for him and bought his house when he was struggling to pay his bills. Despite this absolute unconditional love and support, which he had been blessed with since day one, he would commit the ultimate betrayal. He murdered his elderly parents in cold blood for the sole motive of financial gain. This is a case that will make you shudder. The thought that anyone could put their own greed above the lives of their loving parents is unthinkable. This is a story of Robert and Patricia Seddon and their greedy and grateful son. I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. Let's get on with today's utterly harrowing case. So let's look at Bob and Pat. Bob and Pat are the parents in this situation and also the victims. They were described by their family as incredibly kind, very loving, very selfless as a couple. And I know that a lot of people, when people have died, will only ever talk well of the dead, but there is so much evidence that stacks up to say that those comments are absolutely 100% true. Their friend and their neighbour, they said that they were just the most lovely, kind, mild-mannered people that you could have ever asked for. They said you could never have had better neighbours than them. And another neighbour actually referred to them as fantastic people and said they were always so kind with my kids and other kids on the street. And I appreciate that a lot of you might have neighbours and friendships with those neighbours, but there are a lot of places in the world, in the UK definitely, where people literally don't know who lives next door to them. You know, you might see them and say a passing hello in the street, but you certainly don't build relationships with them to a point where you can comment like these neighbours are commenting. So it suggests to me that they were stalwarts of that community system and that they are really good human beings. They got married in 1966. They were married for 47 years when they died. They lived in Sale, and that's a place in Greater Manchester area, and it's one of those places that I know very well. And in 1966, they were blessed with their first son, Stephen. And then in 1967, they were blessed with a daughter, Leslie. Bob worked at British Airways as an engineer. He did ground maintenance and he worked there literally all his life. It's really interesting how things have changed, because when you think back to the 60s, 50s, 40s, you genuinely would get a job, and often that job would last a lifetime. I think we're at a point now where people are changing and transitioning a great deal more regularly, but Bob exemplifies that commitment, dedication and growth within a career, and that connecting and committing to that time frame with a particular employer. Pat, she was a cleaner. Obviously, she was a mum as well. And mum, as far as she was concerned, took priority over career. Again, it's a sign of times changing, but she was a literal devoted parent, but wanted to make sure that they had extra when needed. So she was cleaning as a job. They had a semi-detached house in Sale, and it was described, and rightly so, as immaculate. Pat and Bob took enormous pride in bringing up their children in a safe, secure and clean home. She took absolute pride in her home. And I would say, when you think about them on an economic level, they're both working, but they lived a relatively modest life, but a really comfortable life. You know, they weren't people who were big spenders, they were savers. And that's demonstrated in the way that they act with their money around their children. But They certainly didn't miss out on anything. They lived life to the full without excess. Bob, at the time of his murder, was receiving an occupational pension from British Airways, and Pat, she was claiming her state pension. For those of you who are thinking, what's a state pension? Because you don't live in a country where a state pension exists. It is a pension that you receive. Well, if the government have anything to do with it in the UK, it will be a pension that you receive when you're 109 years of age. But back in the good old days, if you were 60 and you were female, you got your pension at 60. If you were a male who stayed to retirement age at 65, you got your state pension and you got your private pension in this case, if you were like Bob and you had paid into one. But for those of you who don't have any support from the government, not that we do really, because we've paid it in our taxes and that's why we get it. The point is, you do get a certain amount of income on a monthly basis. That means your old age is not one where you are completely destitute. Now, there was a real tragic event that happened to Pat and Bob in 2008 because their daughter Leslie died at 40, which is an incredibly young age to die at. She'd basically been diagnosed at the age of 7 with quite severe epilepsy. She'd needed care for this, which Pat obviously gave her selflessly without question. And even though we accept that she made it to adulthood, losing a child when they're 40 is just incomprehensible. They have a whole lifetime to lead again. Also, to add bigger problems to this scenario and a bigger tragic reality, Leslie had a son, Daniel. So he lost his mother, but also he had a mental age of 3. So he had a really severe learning disability and difficulty. And unfortunately, that meant that his care needed to be taken care of, essentially. And Bob and Pat stepped in straight away. And I think that for any of you out there, you may be one of those people who just automatically think, well, this is what I'm going to do. But I think a lot of people would, rightly so, because of the impact a child with severe issues would have on their lives. It could make you a bit reticent. I'm not saying you wouldn't do it. Certainly, I would do it for my own children, but that doesn't mean I'd do it joyfully. And it certainly doesn't mean that I would feel that life had been fair to me. But Bob and Pat weren't like that at all. In fact, the quote was that they looked after Daniel with great love and affection. And again, it's just so representative of the personalities and characteristics of these individuals. They are absolutely lovely. And they are individuals who genuinely seem to have love just flowing through their veins. And they are selfless with the true meaning of that word. They're not doing this for anybody aside from the people that matter. They're not doing this for people to notice that they're kind of individuals that just do the right thing. They're not doing it because they feel a sense of duty. They're doing it because they're just good human being. We're talking about compassion at their core. They are incredibly giving people. And they were not in the best of health as they got older. So they both experienced hardships with their physical health. Pat had a brain aneurysm, so a bleed on the brain, and they are so serious and can leave the individual with a lot of problems. But also, you really are at a point where you're facing death. In that scenario, you know, surviving a brain aneurysm is very complex and you're very lucky when you do. And for her, she had all of these other things going on and she had this sense of duty and love and connection and care with her daughter who she'd lost son, and she's absolutely pivotal in him being protected and looked after. And you can imagine how terrifying it would be for her to have a brain aneurysm. Bob, like a lot of people his age, he had arthritis, but it was on the severe level, and that's deeply debilitating. It's consistently painful. It's chronic pain. And on top of that, he suffered from depression. I can't tell you whether it was depression from a mental health perspective regarding endogenous depression, where he just felt depressed, but I would hazard a guess that it's to do with the fact that he's got severe arthritis and it's very, very painful. And anybody who has chronic pain, it's testament to a warrior nature when you can be dealing with chronic pain and be upbeat and positive, because pain is horrible. It increases stress. Stress increases pain. It's a vicious cycle. And the consequence is that if you have these issues, it's likely going to be a depressing scenario. So you're reacting to that. Also, he'd had heart attack. So if you think about having a heart attack, that's again another vulnerability. And he was also somebody who was taking care of their grandson. So consequently, there's an extra pressure to be okay. And I think that that, again, additionalizes all the issues and compounds the concerns when you are getting older and you can see that there is this individual that you want to look after and protect that is going to be compromised if anything happens to you. Now, despite all of those things that I've just said, so there's a myriad there of pressures on Pat and Bob. There are a myriad of concerns and issues that they deal with.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Member Week is here at Lowe's. Don't miss your chance to get up to 40% off hundreds of items like paint, faucets, vanities, doors, and more. Shop our exclusive deals happening in-store and online now through July 18th. Not a member? Join My Lowe's Pro Rewards for free today and get ready to save more. Lowe's, we help you save. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
On a daily basis. And yet, when it comes to their healthy son, because one of their children was perfectly healthy, the individual that we'll be talking about in detail today, it's clear that they would go above and beyond for Stephen. Ultimately, Stephen Seddon is somebody who had his health, which is something that was denied his sister and his nephew, and even his parents at this moment in time. And yet somehow, in spite of that, he is just a bloodsucker on the family resources. But Bob and Pat, like I said, are incredibly selfless. So they spend a hell of a lot of time trying to help their son and his family in whatever way that they could, no matter how much it costs them. And ultimately, it's going to cost them the most precious thing that it could cost any human, which is their lives. But what I'm trying to get across in the description of Pat and Bob there is, if you ever wanted to find parents who exemplified what it is to be a truly unconditionally loving person in another person's life, they are it. They are it. These are the kind of individuals that you can't canonize them. You can't be like, Pat and Bob, I've decided from the Vatican to make you saints. But they should be, because they are such lovely human beings. Somehow, in spite of everything I've just told you about these incredible human beings, it seems that it's not fair, children that sometimes are born to you. Like, you want the best for them, you want them to be the best, and yet somehow you're basically delivered an antichrist. And I don't even say that in a sarcastic manner, although it may have come across that way. So Stephen Seddon, let's take a look at him. Now, he's also referred to in my research as Nick. Now, some of you might be sitting there going, what do you mean he's referred to as Nick? It's called Stephen. I know, but the thing about the 1980s and 1990s is that didn't stop us. I had loads of friends who had completely different first names and actually used either their second name or a completely different name. And everyone was like, that's fine. You know, they'd call out the name Angela in the register and Angela would go, it's Julie, it's Julie. And from then on, we'd call her Julie, even though clearly her birth name was Angela. Couldn't wrap my head around it. It just felt like you could pick anything, just make it stick. But at the end of the day, it was popular in the 80s and 90s. So just throw a name you preferred in there. He grew up in Manchester, as I have, and I would say that his early childhood wasn't bad. I don't think there were too many red flags at all from what I've turned up. I think he could be quite boisterous, quite loud. I think that he was somebody who was physically quite determined as a young person. But certainly when we think about the earlier years, primary school age, there was nothing that was so triggering and red flag orientated that it stands out as very different from other children. He was quite popular. So it wasn't as if he didn't have peer relationships and friendships. He managed to cultivate relationships. And arguably, he was somebody that, to all intents and purposes, should have gone down a really positive track. He was intelligent, he was street smart, and he was savvy. These are all things that start to develop further as he gets into his teens. And when you think about getting to the age of 12, 13, you are starting to develop a sense of self. You are starting to be more confident about who you are at times. You are physiologically going through massive brain matter changes. You are certainly going through massive relational changes. You are trying to find visibility in a world where kids are kind of invisible a lot of the time. And you can go down different paths to do that. For him, when we think about hormones, relationships, wanting to stand out, visibility, etc., it feels like 12, 13 is that pivotal age, and he actually starts committing crimes, which is utterly blindsiding and horrifying for his parents, because this is not the kind of people that they are. We are talking good, pro-social, perfect neighbors, loving parents, carers, and so on and so forth. And yet we're in a scenario where a 13-year-old son of theirs is getting into hot water. They are embarrassed by it. They are ashamed by it, but they are supportive of him. It never wavers. And there will be people who say, well, you know what? That is one of the problems with consequential behavior. If you don't wager a reality and actually let that person know that if they continue doing A, B, or C, there will be the withdrawal of your support. People will say that can contribute to affirming and reinforcing terrible behaviours. I don't buy into that. I'm not from the school of hard knocks. In fact, I've done a lot of research around this because I have the privilege of working with fundamentally very, very vulnerable individuals from incredibly abusive homes, etc. And the truth is that when you withdraw further support from even scenarios like that, they're going to fall harder. And when you're from a good home, it can be really difficult to not think, well, there should be some really strong consequences when my child is acting A, B, or C. But usually the best antidote to that is love and nurture and care and compassion and understanding and a figuring out and a figuring forward of what has changed systemically in their life, physiologically, in their body, hormonally, in their biology, and so on and so forth. And so I totally understand why his parents still support him. And at 13, I will say in Manchester, it is not completely out of context for young men in particular to start getting involved in things that they shouldn't do. Genuinely, particularly when he was growing up, it was quite common for lads to be doing stuff that was a bit naughty. Now, he attended youth courts for burglary. So he was basically getting involved in burglary and also handling and theft. So he was dealing with stolen goods and probably selling them on. And unfortunately, he didn't grow out of it. Because, like I said, a lot of young people do things that are really not acceptable when they're young. They haven't got the consequential thinking. They're not looking ahead at the future and being concerned about what that's going to look like on a CV. They're not even thinking about what it would be like to have a job. They have no concept of the impact of their actions. But what you hope is when they get into 19, 20, that shifts and changes and there is a reflection exercise. And that reflection exercise is, I realize now that those actions have consequences and those consequences are problematic, and it shifts and diverts the behavior to a more pro-social level, meaning that yes, they have erred in the past, but the future will be set in a positive way. Not for him. No. The offending, it's almost like it's core within his nature. He's totally comfortable doing things that you and I would find absolutely reprehensible. So as an adult, he does things like twock, which means taken without owner's consent. So he'd steal cars. And in 1989, he was actually imprisoned at Bolton Crown Court. And the reason he was imprisoned was, one, he's a repetitive offender. And the courts have only got so much compassion and understanding. If you start low level and you get into trouble a few times, chances are you're not going to get a strong sentence or a sentence at all. But if you consistently refuse to change your ways, then eventually you will end up in prison. So he goes to Crown Court and he's charged and then sentenced for obtaining goods by deception and theft. At this point, he also meets his wife, Nicola. He'd met Nicola in a lap dancing bar, so she was an ex-model and dancer, essentially. And at the end of the day, she's beautiful. She's somebody that's obviously going to stand out for him. And she's somebody that he decides that he wants to take further relationship-wise. They get together and then they move as a couple to the northeast of England. And they have three children together. Now, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, sorry, Em, did you just say that he met somebody who was an ex-model? Somebody who was, okay, working in a lap dancing bar, but, you know, obviously it's put together well. This ex-con, this person who's been in prison, doesn't sound like the dreamboat that we'd imagine somebody would wish to, shall we say, collaborate with, and certainly have the fruits of their loins developed, such as the three children I've just mentioned. But there is a reason for that. Because this guy, albeit that he's had a criminal history as long as both of my arms stuck to my legs, with some torso there as well. Genuinely, the reason that she probably found him attractive and the reason he was in a lap dance thing called splurging money is because he had actually been really wealthy. He had done incredibly well for a period of time. So in spite of his history, his future was looking absolutely brilliant. Lived a life of luxury. So to put that in context, he had a £46,000 Bentley at the time, bear in mind. It's a hell of a lot of money. He owned a speedboat. I don't know what you're doing with your life if you don't own a speedboat. I have seven. I don't have any, obviously. That's just a complete lie. Went on exotic holidays abroad. They even had a caravan on Lake Windermere. That's somewhere I go a lot, and they are really expensive. And you have to replace them like every 8 years. Is it just me? I find that weird. Just going to buy myself a mobile home. Going to pay quite a lot of fees to just have it there. And then after 8 years, you're going to make me pay another 60 grand. Doesn't feel appropriate. But anyway, I digress. You know what I'm saying. So he's got this caravan on Lake Windermere. And when they investigated how this man, shall we say, of means that seem a little bit beyond his scope, intelligence-wise, and also historically when exploring what he's like as a thief. And I know, before anybody throws it at me, listen, people change. They do. They absolutely do change. That's why I worked with young offenders for a decade. I genuinely believe that people change. But this guy, no. So when they start investigating why he's so super rich now and doing so well, it turns out that the money had come from a European funding scam. Seriously. So his company was called European Business Support. He created that in the late 90s. And the whole premise was that you would provide grants to small businesses. That was his job. Now, obviously, if you're a small business, it's quite difficult to get loans to start your company or to continue to maintain your company. There's a lot of investigating and often people don't meet the bar. So he creates this ruse, which is you pay me 295 quid and I will basically help you source European funding. Now, this is before the internet was what it is now. Like these days, you will go on Trustpilot or you'll go on reviews. And basically, if there are one stars, two stars, or there are people saying this is a con, it really does stop you from acting on the whole. And it always surprises me when people don't check reviews for any company these days, because they are always there. Some of them are fake. I appreciate you can kind of fake positive reviews, but you will always find the negatives if you look for them and they exist. And it can really help you get that instinct and intuition for whether this is something that you want to do. But back then, it was a different story. And back then, charging 295 quid to help you get European funding. Imagine if you get 2,000 people doing that. We're talking about large sums of money in a short amount of time because people are desperate for finance and he's promising them finance. Now, the firm actually had an overall turnover annually of £5 million. That is a huge amount of money that he's basically scamming off people. He is scamming them completely. He's not going to get them any funding whatsoever. And then we get to 2000 after they've done this investigation. It's taken quite a lot of time because these things do. He gets arrested for fraud and he doesn't even pretend that he isn't guilty. So he pleaded guilty at Teesside Crown Court to fraudulent trading. And for those of you who are surprised by this, don't be. He gets 1 year. I know it's brutal when you think about the fact shoplifters can get longer than that if they repeat. This is a guy with a real history in conning people, in thieving, in stealing, in burglarizing, and for basically scamming people of millions. And these are small businesses who need the money. He gets 1 year. It's incredible how it seems to be that corporate fraud doesn't actually receive the correct reality when it comes down to sentencing, because it ruins people's lives. Like literally people take their own lives over these kind of con situations. And now we're only talking about 295 quid and that was clever. Just go for enough that it isn't too serious. But when it adds up, it demonstrates a real malevolence within his character. Now, during this period, Bob and Pat could easily have rejected him. I mean, I have to say, I am so connected to my children. I'm sure that all of you are connected to your children. We want what's best for them.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
I want to protect them, want to love them, want to give them the best in life. But when they are a grown-ass adult and they have literally conned millions from others to the point where they've been incarcerated, I'm not necessarily feeling that they deserve the kind of support that Bob and Pat gave them. But again, these are individuals who care deeply. They're probably also thinking that if they don't provide him with help financially, then he's going to return to his very ill-gotten gains ways of getting money. So they tried to look after him financially. They'd given him nearly £40,000 in cash. They didn't have a lot of money. Like I said, they were not living lavish lifestyles. They had enough, but they were certainly not wealthy. Also, if that wasn't enough, they remortgaged their home so that they could buy Seddon's house for him. They wanted to keep a roof over his head and also a roof over their grandchildren's heads. Even when it came down to him getting into trouble for car fines, they went ahead and they paid them off for him. Now, you would think that Stephen Seddon would be thinking, I don't deserve these human beings. These are people who have gone above and beyond for the rest of my family. They've dealt with the tragic loss of my sister. They're people who've gone and remortgaged their home to ensure that my children have a roof over their head. How blessed am I, in spite of my horrendous behaviour, in spite of the fact that I've shamed and caused shame for my family? These people are worth their weight in gold to me. That's what you would expect, right? But not Stephen Seddon. No. Them paying his parking fines, them getting out of all the financial trouble, them sticking by him when he's been in prison, none of that matters, because even though he relies on them, a little bit like the person who kills the golden goose, you know, the golden goose is laying those eggs, they're getting that gold, just not all at once. So they imagine, what would it be like if I just killed the golden goose and took all of it? And of course, the moral of that story is, well, the goose was made of blood and feathers and a body that a goose would have, and it didn't actually have gold. Only its eggs were gold. And it's that idea of wanting more and wanting it now that causes the biggest problem. And he decides, yeah, mum and dad have done all this for me, but I want more. He's got greedy. He's got used to a standard of living. He doesn't like his life in the state it is now. He wants to have a better chance. He wants to find a new network financially of support, and he wants to be able to do that, even if that means he has to let go of the tiny amount of ethics and morals he might have had within his head and body. Who knows? I'm not sure he had any with respect. We get to the 20th of March, 2012, and this is an utterly bizarre event that occurs. So imagine he's taking his parents out and his nephew because they're going to go and get some food. And then all of a sudden, this horrific accident occurs. And essentially, his car swerves off the road and ends up in water. Now, just think about that for a minute. They have literally ended up and they are sinking in water. Now, of course, accidents happen. And that's absolutely terrifying. To be trapped in a car as it's going down and underwater, I mean, it's got to be people's worst nightmare. And to all intents and purposes, Stephen Seddon could also die, right? Apart from, of course, we're not talking about an accident, are we? We're talking about the fact that this man, who has had so much from these people, has decided to fake a car accident in actually a murder attempt. Simple as. He's intending that he's going to get out of that car, but he's not intending that his parents or his nephew are going to walk away. The way it played out was he'd driven to his parents' house. He was in a rented BMW and he was taking his parents and his nephew for a belated Mother's Day meal. I mean, could you be any more malevolent than that? To create a ruse where you've told your mother that you're taking her out for a belated Mother's Day meal. when actually you're driving her to her death. So he had literally no intention of ever getting out to the place where they were going to eat. In Manchester, we have the Bridgewater Canal, and they were driving through Timperley, which is where he actually veered into the canal itself. Bear in mind, he's got his mother, he's got his father, both strapped in the back seats. So they were actually strapped in, and his nephew Daniel's also in the car. But of course, it doesn't go to plan. So yeah, he's managed to get them into the canal, but it goes awry because bystanders start to see the crash. And you know how it is. If you see a crash and people are in the water and people look helpless in that situation, ideally, if you're a pro-social, well-adjusted, normal human being, you are going to run to try to get help. You're going to be screaming, you're going to be shouting, you're going to be letting people know somebody needs help. And he wasn't expecting that. Of course he wasn't. If you're a predatory murderer, if you're an exploiter of others, if you're somebody who's psychopathic in nature, you're not necessarily thinking about the consequential reality of other people caring because you don't have an ounce of care or compassion in your body. So how can you relate to people who would, strangers who would potentially risk their lives, for example, to protect strangers? It's not in your psyche, you can't connect. So he's not thought about that. And these bystanders are there and they start trying to help them. And it seems like at this point, psychologically, he realizes he's screwed. Because if he just lets them go down, people will realize, well, how were you out of the car? How come you survived this? How come you stood and watched when your parents and your nephew, who was so disabled, drowned? So at this point, he realizes that he's going to have to do some quick thinking to change the narrative of how people are going to remember it. So at this point, he decides he's going to pretend to be the hero. So he gets himself out of the car and then he helps Daniel escape out of the car. Then, this is super weird, even for the people who are distressed watching this play out, because, you know, if you're in a scenario of panic, even as a bystander panicking, you're going to have an expectation of how things are going to work if there is a car sinking. And you're probably not going to need a lot of motivation to question somebody who sits on top of the car that's sinking in a canal, trying to break the window with his feet. Just throwing it out there. You sat on the car that was sinking. Yeah, I did. I thought I was going to help them get out. You thought that being an additional weight in a sinking car was going to be helpful. I did. I thought I'm probably just going to smash the window with my feet. How did you get out? I know where you're going with this. And that does sound like it makes sense that I got out and got Daniel out, but then decided I'd sit on the car to actually smash the... One might think I was trying to ensure that it went down and that my parents drowned, but I didn't. I'm a hero. Honestly. A taser in the interrogation would be useful for this kind of individual. But that's what he does. And bystanders are screaming at him and saying, get off the car. But apparently, in spite of the fact that he would have been able to hear them, he went a bit deaf for a moment. And so he just took lots of time actually doing so. Bear in mind, his family are going down in the canal, in the car, and it's sinking faster because his weight's on top. And also, one of the things that it does in the water is it makes it more unstable. So it's a much quicker sinking strategy. I don't know. Some people might say he wanted that to happen. So all these bystanders are screaming. The emergency services have been called, of course, because the bystanders are actually caring human beings. And when they actually arrive, he does actually help his father out of the car. But his mum, she's sadly still trapped in the car. Amazingly, and in testament to our incredible emergency services, the fire brigade actually do manage to get her out. At that point, the car had been fully submerged, but they did rescue her. She was completely unconscious. She was near death, essentially. But again, the emergency responders were incredible and they resuscitated her on the bank of the canal and she survived. Now, when they're all taken to hospital because they need to check out what's happened to them, clearly they've been through an incredibly traumatic event. We have two elderly people with health conditions. And also we've now got Stephen Seddon, who's deciding that, oh, I've had a heart attack. He said that he'd blacked out and that he'd probably had a heart attack. That's what had caused him to swerve off the road. The only problem was they couldn't find any evidence of it. Not that Stephen Seddon cares, because obviously Stephen Seddon's just going to spin a yarn and be like, yeah, I've had a heart attack. Yeah, literally, we've tested, you haven't had a heart attack. You think I haven't had a heart attack, but I've had a heart attack. Are you a pathological liar who's conned loads of people in a European scam, gone to prison for a year, spent your entire history from 13 being an offender and can't be trusted as far as you can throw them? That is an appropriate description of me, but I had a heart attack. Oh, it really annoys me. There's nothing physiologically wrong with him at all, but he needs to explain how he's ended up in the canal. And then he says, oh, maybe it wasn't a heart attack. Maybe it wasn't a heart attack. Maybe I've overthought that one and analysed it. Maybe I didn't black out. Maybe there was a brick in the road. I kid you not. Maybe there was a brick in the road. How big was the brick? Was the brick the size of a house? Was the brick the size of a very large human that you needed to swerve out of the way? Was the brick actually a boulder that had fell off a very big mountain with very big boulders? If it's a brick and that's enough to send us veering off roads into canals, well, let's just say emergency services would need a lot more staff and very few of us would be driving those insanely dangerous machines. I mean, it just makes no sense whatsoever. And of course, they go back and look because they're looking at the accident scene and they can't see any debris at all found at the scene. Now, when the emergency responders came and the police came, bear in mind the story that's unfolded. They've seen this man, apparently, allegedly, trying to break into the car. He's removed Daniel from the car. He's removed his father from the car. Yes, mother nearly died. But there is enough evidence there to suggest that he has actually tried to do his best to rescue the people that he loves. And that means that the accident crime scene investigators, they're not thinking this is a perpetrator trying to murder his mother and father and nephew. They're thinking, gosh, something really awful has happened and this man has risked his life. And it made local news, it made the actual news itself, as in on television. And oh my God, it's quite disconcerting to watch, because what you can see is while Stephen Seddon is very good at describing what a hero he is, basically, and making it clear that, you know, he was there at the right time and at the end of the day, worse things could have happened, his dad looks deeply uncomfortable. Like, genuinely, it looks like he's been kidnapped. That's the only way that I can describe it. It looks like he's a hostage. Because if your son has risked their life after a horrible accident to get you out, you are going to, without a shadow of a doubt, be joining in and saying, God, you know, he saved my life. He saved my wife's life. He saved my nephew's life. This horrible accident happened. I was so proud of him, so grateful. None of that. He looks caught in the headlights and he looks deeply uneasy. And it makes sense when you think about the fact that they were experiencing the crash as it happened. They'll have seen that he didn't pass out. They'll have seen there wasn't some kind of big boulder in the road. And that's going to make his father and his mother deeply suspicious. But for those individuals who came to the crime scene, it's seen as an accident. Of course it is. No one questioned it because there's no reason to question it. And when he spoke to the Manchester Evening News, one of the things that he said that is so telling is that the nurses at the hospital called him a hero. He loves that. He loves the fact that people are seeing him in a superior way, a superhuman way to some degree, somebody who risked everything to save the people he loved. And of course, he in the interview says, no, the firemen were the real heroes. Yes, the firemen were the real heroes because the firemen aren't massive murdering bastards. That's right, Stephen Seddon. You're absolutely correct. But you can imagine how Bob and Pat are going to be feeling. I mean, they immediately start suffering from stress, post-traumatic stress disorder to some degree. They get really horrible nightmares as a result of the accident. You'd expect that. Can't even begin to imagine what it's like to be trapped in a car as it's sinking. Let alone.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
Confused on where to start with weight loss medication? See the lowest prices available with or without insurance for Wegovy, Zepbound, and more at TryLifeMD.com. 95% of LifeMD patients said starting their weight loss journey was simple. Listen to Tara's story after losing 42 pounds.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. I've gone from 237 to 195. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
Get your free insurance benefits check in minutes right now at TryLifeMD.com. Nearly 96% of patients said they would recommend the LifeMD program to anyone who wants to lose weight. Get started right now at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
Alone, believe that the person who trapped me in the car sinking may have been my own son trying to kill me. In an interview, Bob actually said he kept having really awful flashbacks and that it was really interfering with his sleep. He couldn't sleep anymore. He said he felt terrible. And one of the reasons that he felt terrible is he had this high level of conscience about his wife. He said he didn't want to leave his wife who was trapped in that sinking car, but he just had to get out. So he had this sense of, she could have died and I abandoned her. He didn't. That's just not true whatsoever. But you can see, can't you, the absolute disparity between him and his son. We have Stephen Seddon, who is orchestrating this horrific thing that plays out and almost cost him the lives of his entire family. And we have Bob, who did nothing wrong, was trapped in the back of the car and, yes, got out with help. And because he left his wife, who he adores, who he loves, who he'd been married to for over four decades, nearly five decades, he has guilt even though she's alive, because that's the compassionate, empathic human being. That's what love does. It makes us feel responsible even when we're not responsible. And yet the son, who's genetically linked to them, is devoid of this understanding and connection. The guilt that he felt haunted him right until his death. It's as simple as that. We get to July the 3rd, 2012, and this is really a point where Bob has been ruminating on what happened in the crash. And he actually goes and he spoke to his GP. And he said to his GP, I don't know whether I'm making this up in my head. I don't know whether I'm distorting reality. I don't know whether I'm delusional about this, but I have this really deep suspicion that my son tried to kill me and my wife deliberately in the canal. Now, one of the big reasons that Bob had this, apart from obviously being in that situation and it playing out in reality for him, he said that he'd seen his son Seddon had recorded a Mythbuster episode. And this Mythbuster episode, which is a program that kind of obviously bust myths, it was all about how to escape from a car that had been submerged in water. Now, we all appreciate coincidence, but this is just too big for Bob. And he's already got his sneaking suspicions and he's thinking to himself, I think my son tried to kill me. And now seeing that Mythbusters episode and how to get out of a submerged car, it just triggers that connection that he's not being paranoid, that this is deeper and darker and more terrifying than that. Now the GP is great and says, listen, we can report this to the police. Let's speak to the police. I'll do it for you. But Bob said, no, I want to confront him about this incident myself. And he was going to do it that night. Now, on one level, if you think about Bob, that is a very bad idea. It's a bad idea because firstly, yes, Bob is a really good human being. He's a caring human being. He's somebody who supported this boy as growing up into a man through thick and thin. But this is also somebody he believes is capable of killing him. Now, if you believe that somebody has an intention to kill you, even if it's gone wrong, even the predisposed capacity and capability to murder you, the last thing you should be doing is confronting them. You may think that they have a boundary and levels. You may think that they would acknowledge their actions. You may think it may change their ways. The truth is, if they have that capacity within them and you put them in a position where they're under threat, what outcome could occur? And it's not that Bob is doing something that isn't understandable. It's that he's doing something that is incredibly dangerous for his health and well-being. Because Seddon hasn't got boundaries. If Seddon wants them dead, the last thing he wants is to think that they know that. Because again, that's going to put him in a very precarious situation. We get to the July 4th, 2012. This is when Bob and Pat see their last day, essentially. Seddon leaves his car, and he leaves his car specifically in his garage in Seaham. And the reason for that is that he knows that the electricity was going on and off, and that would mean that essentially he was trapped in Seaham. He also went above and beyond to let everybody that he knows know that he would be stuck in Seaham all day. So he's instantly and loudly saying to people, hey guys, I'm not going to be able to leave this area at all with my car in particular because it's stuck in the garage. So I'm just going to be kind of wandering around. Also, he went out of his way to make sure that it was seen on CCTV in Seaham. Just lining up this alibi. And I want you to think about the fact, the level of premeditation in that action. This is somebody who is plotting and planning and knowing what he needs to do to be seen as an innocent party. The premeditation there is just chilling. Because when I talk about what happens to his parents, fundamentally to know that you're going to do what he actually does and to be so cold and calculating and so capable of almost creating the perfect situation where you could get away with murder. When we think about antisocial personality disorder, we think about psychopathy, we think about narcissism, this guy is absolutely connecting. You think about the dark triad, Machiavellian, psychopathic, narcissistic, he's absolutely ticking all of these boxes. He even went so far as to leave his mobile phone with someone that would be in Seaham all day. Why? Because it means that when they look at where he was and it's connecting with mass in Seaham and not in Sale, that he believes that will make him look like he was definitely there. So he's carefully plotting to make sure that at no point he would be suspected. Then he borrows his brother-in-law's car. Now this is where you go, what? What? So he's carefully orchestrated leaving his mobile phone, being seen on CCTV, not having his car available to him. And then it's like, but I still need to go to the place where I need to carry out the crime. And I don't want to be suspected in any way. I do not want anybody to be able to connect me with this crime. I need to really think about the kind of individual that's completely disassociated from me so that there is absolutely no way that they could potentially connect me. Brother-in-law, my brother-in-law, I'll speak to him. See? This guy might be quite intelligent on one level and street smart, but he's entirely stupid when he's coming down to being sophisticated in a forensic way. Not that he'd believe that. He's one of those Billy Big Bollocks who thinks that he knows exactly what he's doing. But we want that. We like narcissism in these cases because it means that there are chinks in the armor of these killers. So then he borrows his brother-in-law's car. And of course, roadside cameras see the car, see that it's traveling from Seaham to Sale. We'll be able to connect the fact that it's the brother-in-law of him and so on and so forth. But he thinks he's going to do this. He thinks he's going to get away with it. So he drives to their family home. But what he's got with him at that moment in time is a sawn off shotgun. Now, I'm not a ballistics expert and I don't know a lot about guns. The UK, we don't legally have them on a daily basis in our homes. I know it's very different in the States, for example. But I do know what a sawn off shotgun will do to you. And I know the horror it inflicts on the body. I know it literally eradicates areas of somebody's body when they actually meet their fate by a shotgun that's been sawn off. But he'd managed to acquire this from, shall we say, his criminal acquaintances. And he arrives at the home. Now, bear in mind that Bob and Pat, as far as they're concerned, they are answering the door to their son. Why would they not? Why would they not just open the door no matter how dissatisfied, no matter how scared, no matter how suspicious, you're going to let him in. And that's the most upsetting part, isn't it? That you open the door to this human predator, this killer, somebody that you created, somebody that you've cared for, somebody that you've looked after financially, and all the while, all they have is a serious intent to do you harm. In this case, to take your life. So we don't know exactly what played out, but what we do know is he walks into that house and Bob's killed while sat on the couch in the living room, meaning he was not expecting it. He was shot in the neck and he was shot at a distance of 1.5 metres. There is no way you are going to survive that kind of injury. Pat was found in the hallway. She'd been shot in the head at really close range, and as she lay on the floor, even though she had been horrifically wounded, she still tried to fight her son off. She knew he was her killer. Gravely injured, still fighting. It's incomprehensible, isn't it? Such a lovely lady, such a life of care, to die at the hands of the child that she birthed. Bear in mind, this is while she's still recovering from that horrible trauma of the car crash 3 months earlier. Her injuries were horrific. Most of her face had been blown off. She'd been shot in the left temple. Then Seddon finished his plan. He placed the weapon on his father, positioning his right hand on the gun, trying to make it look like it was in a murder-suicide, no doubt, recoiling from the horror and trauma of their near-death experiences. Bob had snapped and murdered his wife of nearly 5 decades, believing that he could outsmart the investigators, outsmart the police, believing that he could get away with the perfect murder. But of course, the problem with that is you'd need to know a lot about guns to make a shotgun sawn off actually be a suicide weapon. Because they're so big compared to a normal gun, sawn off or otherwise, that it would be almost impossible to use it on yourself. And for Bob, he wasn't a tall guy. So when the investigators come and they look at the crime scene, what do they know? That Bob's arms were not long enough to have been able to shoot himself from that angle and distance. And also, where the gun was actually found, it was inconsistent with the idea of a suicide, so the gun wouldn't have ended up on his lap, because when you fire a shotgun, in this case a sawn-off shotgun, it would recoil from the firing, and therefore that position wouldn't work. So immediately they are absolutely suspicious and they are not looking at Bob as the killer. They are looking at this case as a murder case, and now they're looking for the perpetrator who's carried out this killing. It took Seddon just 15 minutes. 15 minutes. He got into that house, he shot his parents quickly, and then he got out. The brutality, the treachery, the betrayal. Unbelievable. Just no emotion, no shock, just cold, calculated killing. And then he just drove back to see him. And even worse, he did some shopping. Now, when he was caught on CCTV doing that shopping, he was actually buying beer. Now, what I would say is that in some of the research and some of the articles and some of the news bulletins that I've looked at, the suggestion is that he was basically celebrating with beer after murdering his parents. Now, I think, okay, that's one explanation, that, you know, he was feeling relieved because he was going to inherit money. But I actually don't think that was the case. I think he's still in that I'm going to get away with murder mode. And he's thinking to himself, what would I buy normally? Well, I'd buy beer. And secondly, I want to be caught on CCTV. It's all about adding to that alibi. I'm back. Look, I couldn't possibly have killed this person or these people because I'm in Seaham shopping for beer. But of course, the thing that makes this story fall down completely is the car. It had been seen by cameras traveling from the sale area towards the northeast. And there had actually been 21 minutes before the car arriving in the sale area and leaving in the opposite direction was spotted. So they have him essentially banged to rights. They know it's him. He's borrowed the car. They now have the car going to Sale where his parents have been murdered and then leaving the area very, very quickly. So he's never going to get away with this. But he doesn't know that. It took a couple of days for Bob and Pat's bodies to actually be discovered. So it was July the 6th when they were found. And the reason for that is that neighbours just didn't feel comfortable with the fact that things weren't changing in the house. Remember, Bob and Pat were well loved in their local area. They were considered fabulous neighbours, caring neighbours. So they kept an eye on others and others kept an eye on them. And they see that things in the house aren't changing. So Bob and Pat's curtains hadn't been opened. And also the bins hadn't been brought in. This is what Bob would do always. It's just a ritual. He wouldn't leave them out. The washing hadn't been hung out at the usual time. And again, I think in the modern era, a lot of people think, what do you mean the washing hadn't been hung out? But it's the same with my grandma and my mum and dad when my dad and my grandma were alive, you know, habits stick hard. For example, I once turned up at my grandma Taylor's on a Tuesday at a time that she was going to go to Morrison's supermarket. Now you would imagine that when your granddaughter turns up and you gotta go to Morrison's supermarket, you put it back an hour or two, because at the end of the day, Morrison's supermarket ain't going anywhere in those 2 hours, not my nan. My nan was like, it's shopping day, it's 1 o'clock, we have to go to Morrison's. And I remember that trip to Morrison's because she bought me a really nice cake. The point is, habits are hard to break. And Pat always hung their washing out at the usual time. Also, neighbours had tried ringing them because clearly they were thinking what's going on and they weren't answering the phone. They stuck reliably to their routine, essentially. They were creatures of habit. And because this wasn't being followed through, the family were really worried. Also, it's worth noting that Daniel, the grandson, he hadn't been in the home at the time. He'd actually been away, staying in respite care. And let's be honest, I likely believe that he would have been murdered too. I don't think that his uncle knew that he wouldn't be there. But when the carer comes back with Daniel, they're the one who actually gets to have the horrific...
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
In the news this week, the Have I Got News For You podcast is back for another series.
Brought to you by some of the team behind the show, we'll take you through the big stories of the week when the TV show can't.
From Kemi Badenoch to Keir Starmer, Donald Trump to Nigel Farage, we'll make sure to give every story and subject the complete lack of respect it deserves.
We also cover all the sillier stories you've missed that don't make the front page and put your news knowledge to the test with our missing words round.
Listen and subscribe to In the News This Week, the Have I Got News For You podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.
Reality of seeing Bob and seeing Pat dead. So they call in the murders at that moment in time because they arrive at the house. Bob's obviously slumped on the couch and then Pat's dead in the hallway. So at this point, the police obviously call round, they start investigating and they have to inform the immediate family members who are left because they have to let them know that this horrible thing has happened. So police officer has to break the news to Seddon. You have to imagine at that moment in time for that police officer, he really is talking to somebody who is likely going to be absolutely devastated by those words that your parents have been murdered. So when that officer has that conversation and calls him to inform him that his parents have been killed, he says, what am I going to do now? I'm going to lose the house. The mortgage is in my dad's name. Bear in mind, as I said earlier, Bob and Pat bought him his home. So that's why the mortgage is in his name. And essentially, he's probably thinking, how do I look really innocent? I have to say something to this police officer that makes me look like, you know, I would never kill my parents. So I will make it out that I'm now at risk of losing my home. Now, anybody who has, I don't know, 5 brain cells that aren't fighting each other knows that if you die, you always have a life insurance attached to the mortgage as part of the policy of the mortgage. And therefore, it would have paid off the mortgage. And as he's the sole inheritor of the estate of his parents, it would actually mean that he got his house paid off. But by this ruse of acting distressed about his own life, you know, I can't kind of get my head around it. You know, you get a call, the police officer's like, I'm really sorry, your parents have been murdered. What? I'm really sorry, your parents have been murdered. Oh my God, my parents? Yeah, it's really awful, they've been horribly murdered. What am I gonna do about my home? I'm gonna lose my home. Oh my God, I've just gotta think about my own needs. That's the most obvious reaction that you'd have, as opposed to, oh my God, what has happened? Tell me about this. I'm devastated. I'm lay on the floor. I'm screaming. You know, all of those stages before we get to the point of worrying about losing your own home. But that acting charade, it's all about looking like, I'm not going to financially benefit. I'm so stupid that I don't know this. And therefore, I'm going to deflect suspicion away from him. But it's not going to. It's going to do quite the contrary. It's not a normal way to respond to devastating news. It's very selfish. It's very money orientated. And if you are actually an officer delivering that news and you've actually been in situations where you've seen loss play out before, you're going to immediately think there is something really wrong here. Now, it takes no time at all to arrest Stephen Seddon. They have all of that footage I've just talked about. They also have grave concerns now about the other car situation where they ended up in the canal, and they want to bring this man to justice. The trial is at Manchester Crown Court. Prosecutor Peter Wright QC, he argues as the prosecution that Seddon murdered his parents for money. Basically, there was £230,000 worth of inheritance, and Seddon would have been the sole beneficiary of their wills. Bear in mind, on the day that he killed his parents, there was only £5.45 in his bank account, so he was really struggling financially. Also, he was applying to payday lenders. And for those of you who don't know what payday lenders in the UK, payday lenders are basically loan sharks. I don't know what's happened in the past 20 years. It's like loan sharks who used to go around and kind of roughhouse you if you didn't give them the money and make you pay 6,000% interest, which made it almost impossible and impractical to ever pay it off, meaning you were paying off debts for the rest of your lives or you'd get kneecapped. Nowadays, somehow the government allowed them to just become more legal. Just like, oh yeah, just put 3,422% interest on that payday loan. You do that. Yeah, it's fine. It's legal now. You don't need to beat them up. We'll just take them to court, take the house off them, for example. That happens. But payday lenders are really crippling. It's once you get in the system of doing that and loaning the money from them, it's just a consistent cycle and it ruins people's lives. It's why people take their lives sometimes to do with finances. And it's also why a lot of people end up with IVAs where they just write off all the debt and pay back a certain amount because they literally cannot afford to live because of these bloodsuckers. So he's got into that cycle. Now, bear in mind at the time of that, Seddon and his wife had no job. And his wife had even gone so far as to borrow money from the Department of Work and Pensions Social Fund in 2010, 2011, which means that they were really crippled financially at the time, because you have to be to get that money. Now, like I said, because he's now been arrested for the murders of his parents, because they'd initially thought that the car crash was actually an accident, they actually revisit this at the murder trial and then they reopen the investigation. So it's suggested at this point that this was Seddon's first attempt on his parents' lives. And there were a number of reasons for that, a number of reasons pointing to his guilt, essentially. So first off, Seddon had actually chosen to drive a hire car for his journey. Bear in mind, he'd actually been driving his own car earlier that day. Also, he had insured the excess on the hire of the car. Now, come on, if you are taking a car out for a day, well, I say this, maybe you're a really terrible driver. And when you hire a car, you do take all the extra stuff to write off the excess and all the additional insurance because you think probably going to end up in a canal. But for the mass majority of us humans, if you're borrowing a car for a day, you're not thinking I'm going to pay the excess because you just think you're not going to have an accident. He's informed himself of how much that's going to cost and realized, well, it's going to end up in a river. So I need to make sure that I paid it so that I don't have to pay out myself. Also, he had taken with him a knife and a crook lock, And he used that to actually get out of the sinking car. So the belief was that he didn't just want to kill his parents, he wanted to kill Daniel too. So Daniel was in that car during the initial murder attempt. Also, when they found out about the gun and the fact he had the sawn-off shotgun, he'd actually taken 3 cartridges for the gun on the day of the murders. So it's highly likely he was going to kill Daniel as well. He just thought that Daniel would be home and he thought he'd wipe out the entire family. So there's no spectrum of acceptability where murder is concerned. We all know it is absolutely harrowing that he would kill his parents. But you have to remember, Daniel has the developmental age of 3 years old. He is very disabled, incredibly vulnerable. What kind of psychopathic killer thinks that killing that child, because that's what he is. Age-wise, he isn't. Age-wise, he's older. But he's a child in his head, and he was comfortable doing that. So this person who's already lost his mother tragically, has now lost his grandparents tragically, and was going to lose his life if Seddon had his own way. Now, of course, when it comes down to the evidence, there's so much harder evidence that when Seddon gets to court, all he can do is say, "I'm not guilty." Is it just me? I tell these stories again and again, and in my head, I have so many consequences for people who do this in court, genuinely. Now, on one level, there's a bit of me that goes, nice one, because he's going to get done for this. He's banged to rights every day of the week. Yes, he's superior. Yes, he's arrogant. Yes, he believes that he can get away with whatever he wants to get away with because he's so delusional about his own grandeur, so to speak. But when it comes down to the positives of him refusing to accept responsibility, we know that sentences are sterner. And my God, this man requires a stronger, sterner sentence. Probably thumbscrews as well. You know, just some of the good old torture equipment. I'm not saying hung, drawn and quartered. I do think that was going a little bit over the top, if I'm honest. Just, you know, moving loads of rocks from one side of a yard to another side of a yard for, I don't know, 230 years. Something like that for me would work. So yes, Seddon basically denies all of the charges against him, and from the docks even does this dramatic thing where he goes, "No, I did not murder them at all. I am an innocent man." And the jury were like, "Clearly, why are we even here? Sorry, why are we here? This is clearly a man who stood in the dock saying he didn't do it. Obviously he's completely innocent. I know all the evidence is there that stacks up completely against him and he's a narcissistic lunatic. But the truth is, we're going to go home now because that is a not guilty man. Yeah, he's got a massive criminal record. And yeah, we genuinely think that he tried to murder them before. But apart from that, he's obviously innocent. Look how dramatic he is." The judge actually was like, "Be quiet." And again, I think more choice words could have been used, but never mind. Now, initially, he denies even going to Sale on the day of the murders, said that, "No, I've been stuck in Seaham all day, stuck in..." Your brother-in-law said that you borrowed his car. I mean, you know, people confuse themselves. We have you on video driving to Sale. "This seems like you've got quite a lot of your things in order here, but nonetheless, I was definitely just in Seaham." We literally have you going to your parents' house and then leaving. I don't know whether you've ever been hypnotised, but look around the eyes, nod in the eyes, you're under. Honestly, you can't believe that these individuals think they're ever going to get away with it. So in spite of saying they've been stuck in Seaham all day, the evidence disproves the lie. And of course, then he's like, "Okay, you've got me there. I did actually go to Sale, but you've got it wrong. I didn't go to Sale because I wanted to kill my parents. I went to Sale because I needed to pick up drugs." Okay, so you're saying that you drove all the way from Seaham to Sale to pick up drugs. That's exactly what I'm saying. But why did you drive to Sale when you were in Seaham and you could have easily got drugs in Seaham? "Oh, no. It's a very particular drug. It's a particular drug that's only available in Sale." "What drug's that?" It's Sale cannabis. It's very specific. It's a specific strain of cannabis from Sale. That's what I'm saying. Honestly, just, can somebody not just slap somebody with some kind of large, heavy legal manual in the face at this moment in time? But that's what he does. He suddenly remembers that he has gone to sale by borrowing a car off his brother-in-law, driving there so that he can get drugs, even though that makes no sense whatsoever. And also, if you had done that, no matter what, if there is an investigation into your parents' murder and you can contribute anything to the investigation, you are going to be able to say to the police, I went and scored drugs from sale that day, and they're not going to be concerned about it. They've got bigger fish to fry. The jury were like, oh my God, if I wasn't convinced of his innocence before when he stood in that dock and said, I'm an innocent man and I didn't kill anybody. Now he said that he went to sale for drugs. I can see that there is no way a guilty man would ever say that he'd gone and scored drugs unless he wanted to exonerate himself from the investigation, because genuinely, he's an innocent man, as he said, of the stand. No, the jury were like, ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. But not as ridiculous as he suggested it was that he'd kill his parents, because that's what he did. During cross-examination, he was like, it's ridiculous that I would kill my parents. No, it's not, you massive parent-murdering POS. Also, because, you know, why not throw in some more comments about your innocence? He suggested that the idea that he would have tried to kill Daniel too was sick. Was it? It was sick, was it? Well, you literally drove them into a canal and then you sat on the roof and you genuinely wanted them dead. And we know that. So yeah, you are sick. At least you have that contextually correct. You are a very, very sick, inhumane horror of a human being. Of course, when it comes down to the car veering into the canal, he says that was an out and out accident. I can't believe that you're accusing me of doing this, but they see straight through it. And after a 5-week trial, the jury finds Sedham guilty. Now, when it comes down to actually sentencing, I like this judge. I really like this judge. He was sentenced to a minimum term of 40 years. And he was 46 years old when that happened. So that's 2 life sentences for the murders and 20 years for each attempted murder. The parole board will be allowed to consider him for release in 40 years. But that means he'll be 86 years of age and he'll also be on license for the rest of his life if he's released. And I imagine he'll be carried out in a box, which is a really good thing. I hope the box swerves in front of a brick and ends up in the canal. Just throwing it out there. Solve a few funeral costs, if nothing else. The reason that that particular sentence was given, and it is a very strong sentence, is because there were so many aggravating factors. You know, it was murder with the use of a firearm, it was murder for gain, and the murder of 2 people, of which were his parents. There were loads of aggravating factors when it came down to the significant planning and premeditation. There was clearly an element of the abuse of trust, you know, an element of vulnerability because his parents' age and status played into that. And when it came down to the sentencing remarks of Mr. Justice Hamblin, who I think also has a little connection with the dramatic, and I love it, is that he said this, in Greek mythology, someone who killed a parent would be pursued until death by the Furies. Throughout time, it has been recognised as a terrible and unnatural crime. You have killed not one parent, but both of them. You have done so for gain. You have done so by the barbaric act of shooting them at point-blank range with a sawn-off shotgun. In effect, you executed your own parents. One can only imagine the horror of your parents' last moments in this life when they realised what a monster their own son, who they loved, had become. Mercifully, their deaths were swift. Ooh, it gives me chills. Honestly, summing ups can be very disappointing. I've done them many times in my videos. He did not disappoint, did he? He really thought about that. And you can almost hear the sense of desired justice in his voice. He's like, I am sending you down for a very long time because of what you did to those good people. Now, after Seddon was arrested, what they did because of the car accident and the ultimate reality of what was suggested, it being an accident, they referred that to the professional standard branch because they wanted to look into whether a mistake had been made. You know, had the fire and emergency responders and police screwed up? But it was found that there was absolutely no problems in the original investigation. When asked if the police could have done anything to prevent the deaths, Detective Superintendent Denise Worth said he portrayed himself as a devoted and loving son and told lie after lie after lie. He was a very convincing man. Hindsight is a wonderful thing. It's unlikely, with respect to the police, that they could have ever predicted this. Let's be honest, he managed to get 5 million quid in a year out of unsuspecting business people who wanted loans from Europe. He's a con artist. And when you're a con artist, you have the charisma and charm often, along with the psychopathy and antisocial behaviour, that enables you to convince people of things that you shouldn't be able to convince them of. You are adept at being able to build rapport and to exploit people. So I think that the police are absolutely right. We always call into question the actions of emergency responders and the police and anyone who has missed opportunities and where there are lessons that need to be learned. In this case, that isn't so. At the end of the day, Seddon was manipulative, convincing and very, very dangerous. He put on a massive show of being grateful, for example, for the firemen saving his parents' lives. He was caught on camera when they did some interviews with him returning to the scene of the actual accident himself, and he got really emotional. Like I said, his dad was totally onto him. He got really suspicious after finding the Mythbusters episode. But how would anyone else have actually understood there was an intention to murder them? I don't believe that the emergency services screwed up in any way. You know, the dad spoke to the GP, who even offered to help, but you have to say to yourself, well, was it that confrontation that his dad talked about? You know, he said after he'd seen the GP, he was going to actually speak to Stephen Seddon that evening and he's going to confront him about suspicions. That could have happened, and that could have actually been the deciding factor that essentially pushed Seddon to carry out the murder on the day that he did, because he might have thought, well, maybe dad's going to go and tell the police about this and then I won't be able to get the inheritance because I'll be in trouble. Now, obviously, it's impossible for me to say exactly what happened, but to me, it just feels far too coincidental that he spoke to that GP about confronting his son, about a potential murder attempt the day before he was actually murdered. For me, that's too close for comfort. And when we think about Stephen Seddon, it is his MO to exploit people and to get whatever he needs from them. The idea that the golden goose genuinely had come to an end because his father had these suspicions could well have been the tipping point that signed and sealed their doom. Isn't it astonishing that they could have been such incredible parents and this ultimately is how their lives were ended? Isn't it devastating that Daniel won't have the loving attention and care of the people who loved him and doted on him and protected him and took over the care of his life when his mother died, and now they're dead? And for what? For Stephen Seddon to end up in prison for the rest of his natural life, realistically. Makes no sense at all that he felt compelled because of his own greed to snuff out the lives of those who gave him life itself. As a mother, it's your worst nightmare. Those you created can steal your breath. Those who created can want so little for you that financial gain is more important than your life. Truly harrowing. That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.